Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, July 1st, 2013. We're halfway through this year. And here on the left coast, it's sizzling hot. Strange weather. Dark clouds in the sky. And ordinarily, I don't talk much about the weather, because often our weather is better than many of my listeners are experiencing across the country. But we're in a heat wave here in the West that led to a wildfire in Arizona that claimed the lives of 19 firefighters over the weekend. And this was a result of a lightning strike fire in an area that hadn't had a wildfire in over 40 years, so you can expect there was plenty of fuel for it. But we are now in the fourth or fifth day of what appears to be a nine-day stretch of 100-degree temperatures here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I just like to point it out, not because I object to the weather, but because of the denial that remains about human contributions to climate change. And we've seen massive flooding late, you know, well beyond the spring thaws this year. And the extreme weather conditions that we're experiencing worldwide really have to lead to some sort of action. And while President Obama has been getting a little bit more forceful in talking about climate change, and I appreciate that, I'll take it. As I pointed out last week, he gave a great speech, but the actions that he is taking, I think, are badly timed. We've got the nomination of Gina McCarthy to head the EPA dangling in the United States Senate as the president offends the members of Congress by saying, well, I'm going to do it all myself. And of course, he's got no other choice because Congress is locked down by the carbon-producing interests that maintain the denial of climate change. So I don't see how this is going to change. Later this week, we're going to connect with Steve Horn for a deep download. Steve Horn has been writing about the Keystone XL pipeline. Last week, he revealed that we don't even know the explicit route of the pipeline. It's shrouded in secrecy. There are many other issues related to climate science, the expansion of fracking in this country. And if you haven't seen Gasland 2, I know it's been pre-screened. I think it's going to open in theaters in the next few weeks. And Josh Fox was on television the other night with an excerpt of it. And we really need to come to grips with this as a nation and as a world community. And the U.S. will have to take leadership for anything significant to happen. I wasn't planning to report on the protests in Cairo and other cities in Egypt over the weekend until the story broke this afternoon that the generals in Egypt have given a 48-hour ultimatum to President Mohamed Morsi. Now, he's only been in office about a year. It was the generals who evaluated the election and decided that Morsi had won. But because it's been such a fractious year under Morsi's attempt to consolidate his power, and because of contention continuing about his role as a leader in the Muslim Brotherhood, and what exactly that means, it's created quite a few problems. So the communique issued by the military leaders was read over state television. It echoed the announcement of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces issued 28 months ago to oust President Hosni Mubarak, the dictator who had been there for three decades. But the scope and duration of the military's latest threat of political intervention and its consequences for Egypt's transition to democracy were not immediately clear, in part because the generals took pains to emphasize their reluctance to take over. Morsi's advisor, he's not named here, is quoted as saying, "We understand this as a military coup. What form it takes will remain to be seen." The ultimatum leaves Morsi with few choices. He could resign. He could call for early elections. He could share power with a political opponent or attempt to rally his supporters to fight back in the streets to maintain power. And I don't know why they picked this 48-hour period, but that's what the generals have decided. They hesitate to take complete power. The statement issued by the general said the armed forces will not be party to the circle of politics or ruling, and the military refuses to deviate from its assigned role in the original democratic vision that flows from the will of the people. So, this will be a very interesting week in Egypt, and we'll continue to watch that for you. By the way, we'll be bringing you our news and comment podcast through Wednesday and then take the long weekend to be back next Monday. So I hope you have plans to relax and unplug over the 4th of July break. In Texas, they're determined to ram through those anti-abortion bills. And Rick Perry, the alleged governor there, yeah, he is the governor, he has recalled the House and Senate into a special session and given them 30 days to complete the unfinished business of his pro-life agenda. And we saw last week, Senator Davis, Wendy Davis, staged a valuable filibuster. But it seems like that tool will be taken away from them, given that this is a long deadline, and they should be able to ram through the legislation in relatively short order. And meanwhile, this is not an isolated case. In Ohio last week, while we were all distracted by Wendy Davis and other issues, the Republicans snuck into the state's two-year budget bill a requirement that an abortion provider has to attempt to find a fetal heartbeat and inform the woman if there is one. They will be required to take ultrasounds. And I believe the Ohio bill mirrors the others, where it reduces the legal period that an abortion is possible to 22 weeks of pregnancy. And this is a conscious effort on the part of right-wing radicals in this country to bring a case before the United States Supreme Court. Their claim is, we're not outlawing abortion. We're just putting in some common sense regulations to protect the life of the mother and to talk her out of it. And, of course, by rolling back the legal period during gestation when abortions can be performed, they are trying to chip away at Roe versus Wade and see if they can find a Supreme Court. They know they have four votes. Can they get the fifth to overturn Roe versus Wade, either in part or in whole? That is their goal. Now, I'm glad to see activists in Texas and Ohio stand up on these issues. But we're not seeing any concerted response from the Democratic Party, which claims to be staunchly pro-choice. And there should be a coordinated effort to combat these state-level efforts to roll back access to abortion and essentially to eliminate it without quite banning it. And the way they do that is they demand that doctors have privileges at a nearby hospital, or that the door to the surgical suite has to be a certain distance wide. I mean, all of this is trivial, but it adds up to a very important assault on a right that we kind of thought was a settled issue. And I haven't been able to research to find out if the fine hand of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is behind these similar abortion bills that are popping up in Republican-controlled legislatures with Republican governors quite frequently now across the country, but I suspect that they are involved. And this war on women's health issues continues on a front that we thought was even more settled, and that is contraception. And it's mind-boggling to see religious activists, including the leaders of the Roman Catholic Church in this country, try to create a new sense of outrage when they accepted contraception for decades. They would tell you that it didn't comply with church teachings, but they knew that most Catholic women ignored those teachings. And it wasn't until Obamacare presented this opportunity, because it requires that health insurance provide contraceptive services to women at no charge. No copay, no insurance. It's just supposed to be free. And Catholics have declared that despite their acquiescence on contraceptives for decades, that all of a sudden this is an outrageous incursion on Catholics' religious freedom. And it's so insulting that the Catholic bishops, who have this terrible record on sexual issues, they have no credibility whatsoever. And here this male fraternity is dictating to not only Catholic women, but attempting to impose their values on the entire country. We've got lawsuits percolating from employers who claim that their religious beliefs are being compromised by this. And this is just another example of the weakness of Democrats. Even if you strip away the morality and the wisdom of these efforts, there's political hay to be made by standing up for women's rights. And sure, they pay lip service to it, and you hear particularly the progressive women elected to Washington speak up. But there is no coordinated effort by Democrats, starting at the White House and including the Congress, to take on this coordinated assault on reproductive freedom in this country. And it's so infuriating as well that these pious sons of bitches who go out there and say that, you know, abortion is taking a life and I'm pro-life and, you know, I need to impose this on everyone else in this country. And contraception is the best way to reduce any demand for abortion. And yet they want to turn back the clock beyond the 1950s, beyond Pleasantville, beyond Mad Men. And the American public is largely acquiescing. Again, there are people in Texas, there are people in Ohio. In Ohio, they were demanding that John Kasich use his line item veto to X out these last-minute inserted items in the budget bill. And he used his line item veto to resist extreme Republican demands that Ohio not participate in Obamacare, particularly when it comes to the extension of benefits to the poor under Medicaid. And so Kasich uses his line item veto, but of course not, to protect the interests of women's health. And one of the leaders of this really shrill attack on contraception is the recently promoted Cardinal of New York City, Timothy Dolan. And the New York Times is confirming today what we first reported to you in February of this year, based on a documentary that showed on HBO, produced by Alex Gibney, called Mea Maxima Culpa. It was hard to watch. It told the story of a Catholic priest who ran a school for the deaf in Milwaukee. His name was Father Lawrence Murphy. He was a serial pedophile who molested more than 200 deaf boys. And once he started molesting them, it was a continual process. And once he was exposed, the church transferred him, and then they did ultimately take him out of control of this school for the deaf. But he was allowed to remain after he had first been reported for these disgusting acts. And they took their sweet time, just like they did all across the country. And so Timothy Dolan, before he was promoted to cardinal in New York City, was the Archbishop of Milwaukee. And the New York Times confirms that in 2007, he contacted the Vatican and asked for approval to transfer money out of the church's general accounts into accounts that were beyond the reach of bankruptcy courts. One was a trust fund for cemetery maintenance, where they parked $55 million. And in another account, an investment account, apparently again beyond the reach of the bankruptcy court, they parked $75 million. So Dolan moved $130 million. Why did he do it? To put it out of the reach of the victims of sexual abuse, whom he was then negotiating with to create some settlements. So he drained the church accounts, and I take this as a gross statement of distrust and a lack of basic human decency. So he moves $130 million out of the church accounts and then says, well, we're broke. Let's go to bankruptcy court and settle these sex abuse claims at pennies on the dollar. I mean, there are ruthless capitalists who wouldn't even do this. And Dolan denies all this. After it was published in the New York Times today, he posted on his blog in New York, malarkey. He said the allegation that he tried to hide assets from victims was groundless gossip. Lord knows I've made mistakes, wrote Dolan. But hiding $130 million is hardly one of them. He explained that on the advice of his finance counsel, he had transferred $70 million from the books into a separate account because it belonged to the parishes, not the archdiocese. He didn't address the money that was hidden in the cemetery trust fund. And it's really offensive to me as a recovering Catholic to see these guys with the purple beanies who think that they can lie because they're doing God's work. This is some sort of heavenly deception. I think that's actually a Reverend Moon concept. But it's operative in the Catholic Church, probably under a Latin name. And these people are running a criminal cover-up. It's racketeering. And I even went to some extent here today, and I read some of the critics, the pro-clergy critics of the film Mea Maxima Culpa. And they spin and rationalize like a crisis PR firm. And they dissemble as they defend people who have covered up for perpetrators of sex crimes that occurred over a long period of time. And these people want to tell American women that they can't have contraceptions, that they can't have an abortion? I don't know where they get off. And a little other fiscal malfeasance attributed to the Catholic Church. Monsignor Nunzio Scarano has been bounced from the Vatican, arrested by Italian police. He's being investigated for laundering $26 million through the Vatican Bank. Apparently he did it at the behest of a wealthy Italian family, the D'Amico family, described as shipping magnates from Salerno. They had 20 million euros in Switzerland, and they wanted to get it into Italy without paying taxes on it. So you call the Monsignor, you light a candle, you say a few prayers, and they launder that money for you. Isn't that special? Isn't that God's work? Doesn't that make you feel good about religion, its contribution to life in the world today? In other news, the Pentagon has released a 79-page report on the death last September of Adnan Latif. We have detailed his case with Jason Leopold here in several podcasts. And if you didn't hear them, just enter Adnan Latif in the search window at peterbcollins.com. They'll come right up. He was one of the early individuals taken to Guantanamo. And even before taken into American custody, Adnan Latif had a brain injury. That's why he went to Pakistan to try to get medical help. He wound up being sold into bounty through the warlords in Afghanistan. And sent to Guantanamo. He was cleared for release for years. The most recent recommendation for his release was in 2010 by a task force run by the Obama administration. But because he's from Yemen, he was trapped in limbo there at Gitmo. And the report blames lax efforts on the part of guards who didn't make sure he swallowed his medication. They claim that he was able to hoard his meds and ultimately end his own life last September. And I'm going to link to a detailed story about this written by a friend of this program, Dr. Jeff Kay. He also cites Jason Leopold's work. And Dr. Kay has been really one of the foremost reporters in exposing wrongdoing at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, particularly by psychological and medical professionals. He's helped expose the widespread use of drugs, including methylquinone, which is supposed to prevent malaria, but high doses are given to every arrival at Guantanamo, and it has serious psychotic side effects. So Dr. Kay read the report and has written a post that's at firedoglake.com. As mentioned, I'll link to it in the show file related to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And he breaks down the original narrative and compares it to this official report. And it turns out that Adnan Latif was a very difficult prisoner. I think I would be too if I had a brain injury and I had expected to be released at minimum 3 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And so he'd been acting out, and shortly before he was found dead, about 12 to 14 hours before, they had injected him with emergency medication. They forced a series of injections with Ativan, the antipsychotic drug Haldol, and some Benadryl, which is supposed to counter the negative side effects of the Haldol. And so he was conked out. He slept 12 to 14 hours. And the guards were not paying close attention to him. And apparently, while under the influence of those drugs, he managed to swallow a bunch of pills that he had been hoarding and hiding. Does this sound like a credible story to you? I'm having a hard time buying it. Ed Snowden, still at the Moscow airport, has applied for political asylum in 15 different nations now, including Russia. He's getting mixed messages from Ecuador. Ecuador attacks the United States for its overreaching tactics. And then says, well, you know, he's got to be here in Ecuador before we can consider his request for asylum. But Snowden is trapped in Moscow because without proper travel documents, his U.S. passport has been canceled, and he's stuck there. And there had been a document issued, apparently through Julian Assange's efforts, by an Ecuadorian embassy to give travel documentation on a one-way trip to Quito for Ed Snowden, but the Quito government says, no, that's not legit. It wasn't issued here. So now enter, stage right, Vladimir Putin, the maximum leader of Russia. And he sent some very mixed messages. First of all, he said that Snowden hasn't made up his mind, and he hints broadly that he'd like him to leave Russia. He doesn't want the complication. Then Putin says Russia never gives up anyone to anybody and is not planning to. Then Putin says, if he wants to go somewhere and they accept him, please be my guest. If he wants to stay here, there is one condition. He must cease his work aimed at inflicting damage to our American partners, as strange as it may sound from my lips. That's right, Vlad. It's very strange to hear you refer to the United States as a partner, and that you'd be willing to squelch a whistleblower. Putin went on, because he sees himself as a human rights activist and a freedom fighter for people's rights, apparently he is not intending to cease this work. So he must choose for himself a country to go to and where to move. When that will happen, I unfortunately don't know. So, it's really hard to calculate what's going to happen next year. I imagine Iceland is one of the 15 nations that Snowden has applied to. But getting him out of Moscow could prove to be very difficult. And I am paying attention to critics who think that Snowden is some sort of a false flag operator, some sort of a limited hangout. Webster Tarpley has a piece up about that. And I still haven't seen enough information to conclude much, including that he is somehow a con man. That may ultimately prove to be true, but I don't see it so far. In recent Boiling Frogs podcasts with Sabelle Edmonds, we've raised questions about the remaining slides from the PowerPoint presentation released in the first week of NSA leaks from Ed Snowden. These were the slides that depicted the PRISM interception of email traffic and other surveillance of the Internet. We're told that this only occurs outside the United States or when there is a reasonable belief, defined as 51% confidence, that the specified target is a foreign national who's not in the United States. That seems like a really wobbly standard. Well, over the weekend, four more slides from what we're told was originally a 41-slide package, a deck, have been released by the Washington Post. And it's interesting because they didn't really trumpet this. They're in a competitive position with the Guardian of Britain, and we don't know if the information that Ed Snowden gave to Glenn Greenwald is exactly the same set of information that was given to Barton Gellman, who used to be at the Post and now is back writing articles for them. At any rate, these slides are not particularly damaging because they simply are part and parcel of the earlier package that disclosed to us that the government is claiming that it has the cooperation of Google and Yahoo and Facebook and the other major Internet companies. They deny that, but of course... We don't know who to trust and who can be believed when there are government gag orders on many of these corporations that run big Internet services. So the slides that were released do offer some interesting detail about something called the Unified Targeting Tool, and they have flowcharts set up to show how information can be collected, and it specifically names Google, Yahoo, etc. And then there is a flowchart that shows PRISM collection data flow and how the FBI appears to be the primary collector and then shares it with the CIA and perhaps the NSA. They're not actually listed here. And then the next slide here is called PRISM Case Notations. And again, it's kind of just internal management describes where they park certain types of information they get, whether it's derived from a chat room or email or voice over IP interception. And it has special codes for Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PalTalk, YouTube, Skype, AOL, and Apple. And then the last one is a thing called ReprISM FISA Tips. And frankly, I can't quite grok what it is supposed to be telling us. And it has the look of a ripped page across the bottom, which indicates that the Washington Post decided not to publish the entire slide. So it remains to be seen if they're planning to dribble these out or if this is the end of what will be publicly disclosed by the media outlets of the NSA's PRISM program. And with the fallout from Snowden's disclosures, we reported to you last week that China has piped up in objecting to U.S. cyber warfare and other forms of surveillance. Now the leaders of Germany and France are speaking angrily, and Angela Merkel was pretty nice to Obama when he was at the Berlin Wall recently. But I think that her outrage is building, as is that of French President François Hollande. They describe the disclosures of massive U.S. spying and snooping in Europe as unacceptable. Merkel delivered her severest warning yet. "We are no longer in the Cold War," her spokesman said, "if it is confirmed that diplomatic representations of the European Union and individual European countries have been spied upon, we will clearly say that bugging friends is unacceptable." So we have a case here of overkill by the U.S. We had the technological capability to intercept, monitor, surveil even our allies. And I'll bet you that Angela Merkel wasn't concerned if we were looking for the next sleeper cell in Hamburg. But when you wiretap the powerful, and they find out about it, well, this could be the critical mass we need to throw off this darkness of NSA surveillance and the American police state. And my hope is that we're going to see America's political leaders, including Dianne Feinstein, once she finds out that she's been a target of NSA surveillance, and foreign leaders. And there is that slim possibility that Ed Snowden is some sort of of a decoy or somebody who's being served up. Maybe by Barack Obama, because he'd had enough. And his way out of a compromised position where the NSA is ruling America is to find a way to expose that. So that's that thread is what keeps me from completely rejecting the theories of Naomi Wolf and, as I mentioned, Webster Tarpley. Nevertheless, my bottom line is that we need to keep the pressure on and that we need to see Americans get angry and speak out against this and enable those 26 senators, including four Republicans, who sent a letter last week demanding answers to legal questions about domestic spying. And I don't know exactly how we exit this police state, but I know that's what we must do, and that's what I will continue to articulate. And finally today, you know about the campaign art of Obama from 2008, and the work of Shepard Fairey, who added the rich color tones and the kind of distinctive design to the Obama logo and turned it into the Hope poster. Well, there is a website where people are modifying that art to make powerful political statements right now, opposing President Obama. And so the Yes We Can poster now reads Yes We Scan, with text circling his head that reads United We Progress Toward a Perfectly Monitored Society. In another, the Hope image is captioned Yes We Can Read Your Emails. I have one of those Hope stickers on a sliding door here, just a few feet away from where I'm sitting right now. And I added a little phrase to it. I said, "Hope, you won't send a drone my way, Barack." And Shepard Fairey endorses this. He says, I've never been an unconditional Obama supporter or cheerleader, so I am pleased to see people subvert my Obama images as a way to critique him and demonstrate the wide gap between some of his promises and actions. And Shepard Fairey noted that he subverted his own image during the height of the Occupy movement. There are no sacred cows, and I agree that Obama needs to be called out on an NSA program that overreaches to the extreme and shouldn't be secret. I want to thank our longtime listener and subscriber, Hillary Blanchard, from the Los Angeles area, for sending me that clipping from the LA Times. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I'm Peter B. Collins, and I always welcome your comments in response. Just drop it at humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.